I can tell you what I hope for the next generation as artists, to feel empowered and powerful, to tell stories with like bold chests, full of courage. Yeah, I really hope that our artists start being able to access lore again. As an L-O-R-E, we have mob who are really strong, spiritually powerful, you know. I know it's not everything, you know, some mob can't access lore anymore, but if you can, to be able to do that and to be able to use that so that you can tell your old people's stories.
It's the final episode of Songlines, a podcast shining a light on First Nations artists across WA. Kambarang is here, spring is well and truly in the air, and we are gearing up for the silly season. What a good time to stop and smell the roses with today's guest, Zach James. Zach is a former student at the Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts, who has taken his love of theatre across the country, championing diversity and First Nations representation in art spaces. After a stint on a series of ABC, SBS and NITV programs, Zach turned to script writing, producing 30 forum theatre shows and taking on the role of coordinator of the Constable Care Child Safety Foundation's Theatrical Response Group. During his time, he has also developed the Mudikwila workshops, facilitating the exploration of culture and belonging. You're listening to the final Songlines for Season 1 with Zach James.
Nyangkwil Zach, Nyang Badaman Yamaji na Bedro Murray na Jupan Wongatha. My name's Zach. I'm not Noongar, I'm Wongai, Yamaji and Murray. However, I've been living and operating with Noongar Mort on this Budja for a very long time. So, you know, I always pay respect to all the mob here and to you and your old fella as well. I went through WAPA, Aboriginal Theatre, like a lot of us did.
Ab Theatre Rap.
Ab Theatre, you!
Just say, like, what was it that energy exercise it started with? Jaikafusu?
Oh, Jaikafusu!
Say that to anyone who went through the Indigenous performance course.
You can be, like, across the room and be like, Kafusu longa!
And, like, they would just all come up from the woodwork.
It's like meerkats.
Yeah, it's like Marco Polo.
Yeah, for black people.
Not that I remember what the second one is, but that's fine.
So I did WAPA a long time ago. 2008 was when I graduated from that. I have been writing and acting with Yuriyarkin Aboriginal Theatre Company for a long time. I did my first play when I was 20 with them, which was Carla Cuttigan, the very first version of that. And in that time, I've probably written 11 plays, I think, that were produced professionally and performed.
That's a lot of words and a lot of writing and a lot of smacking one's head against a wall, trying to get words onto a page.
Yes. You get used to it, though.
Yeah.
Just start wearing helmets.
Yeah, it's a good plan.
So one of my major things that I kind of did around 2014 was I was in a show called AMMM, Aboriginal Radio, and that would go on to be on Netflix as well. Play the character
fancy.
Jampa Jimpa. Yes, I know, back in the day. Actually, it was really funny because whilst the episodes were airing, I was also working as a barista. So people would come up and be like, oh, that episode was so cool. Can I get a selfie? I was like, yeah. And they'd be like, so soy latte, yeah?
Like,
it was just
so like
weird.
The dual lives of an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
Is being recognised occasionally and then going to your normal everyday job.
Yes, just being humble. Or you get humbled.
Yeah, all that. Yeah. One of them will happen.
After that, I did Shadow Trackers, which was a show on NITV and SBS as well, where me and Hunter Paige Lashard travelled around Australia investigating traditional mummels, like Aboriginal ghost stories. And that was scary as hell. I've got a lot of stories from there. And then I worked at Constable Care, which some of you mob in WA might recognise Constable Care as the Child Safety Foundation. They're the puppets, like,
string I danger. Remember when they would come to my primary school.
So I was the puppet man, and then also occasionally breakdancing in the suit as well, which was great.
Yeah, that's, it sounds like a whole moment.
The head is like 6 kilos,
oh.
So you're kind of like holding the hat. So I ended up coordinating that for a while, and I was in charge of the high school department where I kind of pushed us into mental health, suicide prevention, which was at the time in Derby, suicide rates were prophetic. It was shocking how much was going on up there. So we spent a lot of time up there before Kyle Morrison came and headhunted me to come back to Yuriyarkin to be creative director, where I was until earlier this year. So
cool.
Did a lot of stuff there. And now I'm at TAFE lecturing in cultural safety and protocols as well.
Wow, look at you go. He is a man of many gifts and many talents. I think as we've talked about before, most artists tend to have a moment or a collection of moments where they realised that they wanted to go into the arts. What was that moment or collection of them for you?
There's quite a few. I think for me, and it's probably for a lot of people as well, I tried to quit because, you know, everyone's like, oh, financial stability, bye, you know.
Yeah, the joys.
Yeah, and I just couldn't stay away, like to the point where it was worth sacrificing financial stability to be able to keep creating art. I can't stop it, even if I try to. Like right now I'm juggling 6 different projects, and that's purely because I started working at TAFE where I wasn't doing creative stuff. So like my music, Mungia, some other stuff going on as well. I'm currently helping co-write the first ever Yamaji opera as well with the Italian Opera Society in Rome as well.
Oh, that's fancy.
Then the point is, I don't say that in the sense of like, oh, you know, look what I'm doing. You can't help it. There's a drive.
You keep going.
Yeah, can't stop. And then once you, I think it's not just status. We're all like mort, you know, we're all family here, and we support each other. We bounce ideas off each other. And art, for me, from a cultural sense, is that, you know, we're the oldest art tellers in the world.
Yeah, it's embedded. Into our culture, it's embedded into us.
And our spirit, we're in, you know, it's there. And a lot of the time I try to tell, the Cutajin series, for instance, which is Knowledge, there's a series.
In Noongar, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said I've been speaking Noongar as well, which was about knowledge. I worked with a lot of old Wajak elders, you know, to take old dreaming stories and try to revitalize them and bring them into primary schools. And that's art, but that's also life. Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, art is, I know it's cliche, everyone says it, but art is life, especially for
more. It's a way of processing it. There is a reason that cliche exists.
Mm. I got a question for you. Spin the dial in here. How'd you go during COVID? With art creation and...
See, I was very lucky during COVID in the sense that I was working throughout that month-long lockdown we had. I was working through it because I had started the week. You know, there was that week beforehand where we all knew things were about to go bad, but we hadn't had the... Yeah, right? So that week, I was starting rehearsals for a spare parts show, and then obviously we got cancelled, but we still had 4 weeks left of being paid. So I was pretty lucky that I was kind of creating throughout it. Yes, I was pretty lucky. What about you?
Well, we kind of went overboard. Like, we ended up taking on so many projects during COVID because we were locked down. So Dear Woman was meant to come in, which is a very excellent play from
Yukon. Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
And we had to cancel that, but it gave us the time to really start scouting around inside WA, start creating writing workshops and start looking for new writers to start mentoring and develop works in. So we took on heaps of projects and then started moving into the cyber side of things as well. Over all the mob over East, they were already dealing with that, you know, throughout the last 2 years. So for me, it was like a catch-up period on that, you know, but there's still that isolation. I don't know. I feel like it might be different for mob because I don't know how you felt, but I never felt isolated really. Like, for me, it was more time that you can sit back and you're still connected with family and everything like that. And it was just more of a time to listen to everything that's going around and then inject your creativity into that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I was pretty lucky because I, for all the listeners, still live at home. So still surrounded by my brothers.
Literally
my
surrounded.
Dogs, and my parents. I think it's interesting because you're right, because you can, and in a lot of ways, this is the year where almost things are catching up, things that didn't happen in 2021 and 2020 and are like happening now. I mean, you look at the upcoming Perth Festival, and it's the first international festival we've had since 2020. So it's interesting how COVID has affected the arts. But I also realise I wouldn't be doing exactly what I'm doing now if it weren't for COVID as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I think is interesting because you're like, oh no, that was horrible. But I'm also weirdly grateful at the same time because this is fun.
Not to get too deeply philosophical here, but I think that, and I think a lot of people also recognise that what COVID did, one of the things was that it really presented opportunity for us as humans, as a community, to kind of reconnect and kind of see priorities there and the work that comes out of that. There's a lot of stuff about isolationism towards the start and fears of, like, you know, end of the world, pandemic.
Yeah.
But I think that what we'll find in the next couple of years is that you're going to start getting a lot of work, which is about
hope.
Community hope. Mm. Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the greatest things. And I think for mob especially, I wrote a paper on it actually a little while ago, and it was the idea that, you know, as Aboriginal people, we've grown so used to walking on a knife's edge that we have knives on our feet, you know what I mean? Like, we're used to it, you know, we've grown gills to swim underwater. So COVID, you know, smallpox, you know, the whole system of, you know, disease and how that worked, it was something we're able to adapt to because we are so used
to adapting.
Whereas for other people who might not have experienced that systemic oppression, and to an extent it was because of lockdowns, that's how someone who's never been oppressed before would see a lockdown as being something that's
oppressive. Oh, yeah, we all know about that, yeah.
Yeah. So it's almost like it brought people down to a level. So bring people down, less stress about working, making money work, meet at the time, has a growth of empathy. You know what I mean? So I think people are starting to able to understand, you know, what it's like to be blackfella in this country, you know, understanding oppression. And then once you start getting that tangible relationship, that's where the art starts coming, you know? And I think that's what we're going to start seeing in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's a lot of the art that comes out. So your playwriting debut, as you said, took shape with Carla Cutterjohn. So first off, what does Carla Cutterjohn mean?
Fire knowledge.
I was testing you there.
Thank you. Did I pass the test?
You did pass the test. Good job. This play was brought into schools, into many, many schools, and brought Dreamtime stories to children who otherwise never would hear them. And so what was that like, being able to bring those stories to a wider audience?
The original version of Carla Cutterjohn was part of the Awesome Festival. It was also my first ever thing that I'd written professionally. And to be honest with you, it was just a privilege, honestly. And also because I'm not Noongar. So being trusted to be able to tell that story as well was really important. Yeah, exactly. And so the cast, the original cast, was Ian Wilkes, Trevor Ryan and Amy Smith.
A banging trio.
Yeah. And sound designer and onstage musician was Joe Louis.
Oh, hell yeah.
So it was a really great experience. And for me, as like, this is the first thing I've ever written, to have such a Murditch cast was just boss, you know, and to be able to talk about this story. And I still remember how it was set up. There was like this massive bird's nest and it was puppets.
Yeah, I've seen photos of it.
And live music as well. It was like, how'd it go? This story gets told in the land of ice. You know, it's like that real kind of Nick Cave.
Yeah.
But blackfella version of it, you know, it was so dope. And I just remember the fact, because we were talking about originally the story of Diddy Diddy when he goes to Mika, the moon, and takes Carla back down, fire back down to Earth. That's the story, you know. And so there was a lot of importance told in that. And so that is a small story, but we expand it into a 40-minute.
Mm.
So it was a real good lesson for me in learning how to, you know, sit down and sit back, because it's all animals in knitting time, cold time, before humans existed. So it was a good time to sit back and just watch animals, see the way they move and try to create the characterization for that, which was then a lesson for the future for when I start creating characters that are human, you know, and how you honour the original story whilst keeping sacred elements out of it, but whilst also making sure it still serves the story.
It's a very fine line to toe. And then continuing on with you and the amazing work you make, you then did a complete 180. And a couple of years ago, no, the first version of it was in 2019, and then it toured last year, was the Hip Opera last year. It toured last year, right?
Am I correct?
I'm losing track of time. So Icelander Hip Opera, and it used hip-hop music to explore pretty intense issues like addiction, specifically meth addiction within communities. What was that like, creating like your first kind of full opera about such intense topics?
I'm pretty open about this. So I'm an ex-methamphetamine addict myself, 8-9 years clean now.
Yep.
So for me, that was the final jigsaw piece in the therapy,
yep,
to be honest with you. And I think if I hadn't worked at Constable Care for so long before, where I was learning about mental health and healing techniques, I wouldn't have been able to do so well on the project. The crew that we're working with was really great. So Layla, the boys from Downside, Moana as well, Kyle Morrison. The space was there to be able to write it, so it worked.
Yeah, the space was created and led in a way that made it possible for you to create that kind of work.
Yeah, and to not feel judged, and like everyone had at least less than 1 degree separation from methamphetamine. So when I first walked into the room, there was just like emotions on the wall. That's how I'd say it. It's just like anger, blah, blah, blah. And like the boys, like Scotty Griffiths and, you know, Daz, Dan Rudens, were just like messing around with sounds. And I spent the first 3 hours just staring at the walls and looking at everything. And that's when the story started to pop into my head. And the way we structured it was that I wrote the story, I wrote the scene, and I wrote what was happening in it, what the character was going through. And then the cast would take that and turn it into a song, you know?
Yeah.
And then that would work like that.
Then you'd stitch it all together.
Yeah, and then stitch it together, make sure it all works. Andrew Bavell was a dramaturg as well, so like shit hot.
You had Andrew Bovell as your drama turn?
I sure did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
We still talk to each other every now and again. So, yeah, he's such a dope
gosh,
writer.
He scored there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was great.
So shout out to Andrew Bovell if you happen to be listening.
Yeah,
you're top knot.
So learning that, and if you ever saw Iceland, you would know that the timelines are completely skewed in that. And that was on purpose because we're like, how do you start almost at the end and then weave it through? And it's been done a million times before, but we wanted to make it different.
Yeah.
And really grip the audience while seeing it, whilst having the important message of the actual impact that methamphetamine has, you know? Yeah. And I was actually able to write some songs in there as well. So it was really good to be able to write as a, you know, the writer of, or librettist is the actual term. Yes.
What a librettist. Fancy term, librettist. Yes.
I'm apparently a librettist now.
You can add that to your CV.
Yes. But then also to add my own experience, you know, like one of the lyrics I wrote was like, you know, the pain from the past, it comes in waves. Sometimes it fades and all you do is kill the pain. You know, if I escape, why the fuck do I still feel haunted?
Mm.
You know, those kind of feelings of addiction of like where you get through it, but you still show the scars in your body.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people who suffer through any trauma, PTSD, experience those kind of things. So it was about showing that side of things whilst also having the positivity in that journey. So incredible. One of the best things I've done in my life so far.
I do have to ask, though, why did you choose hip-hop as the music style?
That was Kyle. So Kyle Morrison and Scott Griffiths started that idea. That was their concept to start with, was like, we want to do a hip-hop. And at the time...
That's cool.
Yeah.
Right.
This is back in the old Murray
Shout
Street
out to
ones.
Kyle.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah, butter.
Way back in the Murray Street
ones? Oh, yeah.
Ones?
We started writing Iceland years ago.
I remember the Murray Street office. Yeah. It had like, it was very brightly coloured, wasn't it?
Yeah. And little mummeries in the roof.
Little like, and then, and it was orange and blue.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And sorry, this is bringing back childhood memories. Anyway, moving on. Continue.
And I remember because we were just doing Good Lovin', which was a safe sex hip hop show by David Milroy. And I'd just done Carly Cudgeon, and we all sat in the room for like a couple of hours. And we're like, what do we do? You know, blah, blah. Oh, let's make an opera. And they're like, oh, let's make it hip hop. And then I got brought into that, and we just went
couple
from there.
Years later?
Yeah, couple years.
Only a couple. Yeah. More like, it would have been almost 10.
2012, I think, was when we first started. And then the show was out 2019. It wasn't that long, but it felt
seven
like
seven years. 7 years, I think, when you're like when you're writing anything, does feel like an age.
I mean, Kangaroo Shoe was 10 years.
Oh, aye. good tie-in, because now I'm going to ask you about Kangaroo Shoe. Because it's not as though I know that play at all.
Tasty and delicious.
No, never.
Why would you know about it?
Why would I know about it? No, not at all. It's not like I cried for the last 20 minutes of it.
I knew.
It's fine. I don't know if you could hear me because everybody else could. That's why I've said to Dad he's no longer allowed to play dead dads.
Yeah.
Kangaroo Shoe was another play that you wrote, which deals with native title, land rights, and cultural heritage. And as you just said, it did take 10 years to write, because I think often the plays that are closest to your heart are the ones that take the longest to write. What inspired the story? What did you want to say with the play?
So Kangaroo Shoe took me 10 years purely because myself as a human being shifted over those 10 years.
I
mean, I've talked about it before in the sense that a lot of it was inspired by my own journey with native title up in Wiluna. So I'm a TO, a traditional owner out there for our native title group is called Jewel.
Mm-hmm.
And that means sparkly because we're shiny.
I awesome love people. It.
Yeah, yeah. It's all tied into our Jukuba, our dreaming story for out there. And it was about my experiences. And, you know, for me, the character of David, who was the main protagonist, but he was also actually an antagonist at the same time. He's up there to, you know, sign away land rights for mining. And that's very reflective of my dad, you know, who works in the mining sector. It was my observation, whereas for me, I'm completely anti-mining. But my dad understood that for him, because my nan and pop were slaves until early 70s. So, and when the equal wages came in, they got forced out of Albion Down Station, which was up there. So dad was like 14 at the time. And so went from slavery into Kalgoorlie, where they had the dog license, where they weren't allowed into town unless they had this license. So dad came from nothing, literally nothing. So you fast forward to 1988, one of the first Wongai people to ever graduate from year 12 goes to Perth, but can't get a rental because he's black.
Yeah.
He can't get a job because he's black. So it wasn't until he met my mum, who is Aboriginal, but she's fair-skinned, like Casper, that they were able to get accommodation. And this is like 1990. So my dad's only 56, and this all happened in
not that long ago.
His life. Exactly. But for him, mining was the thing that gave him the step up
yeah.
to be able to start forming for our family. And I think the reason why it took so long is that I had to mature myself to understand the full process of native title and not agree with the process, but you need to understand both sides of the equation if you're going to write about something properly.
Yeah.
And I think that was why it took so long. And Maitland, your wonderful father.
Good old dad.
He was in Kangaroo from the start. Like, he was part of one of the first people in the developments in 2014.
Yeah.
Like, long time ago. So he's been in it for the whole journey, you know. He's seen the way it's shaped and how it's shifted. And I left it for like 3 years. I was like, nah, stuff this poxy piece of, you know, big Kunyi thing. I'm not writing this thing ever again, leaving it. And then one day I was just in Belgium, just randomly, and an idea came in my head, which was a complete shift to what was written. And then I rewrote the play in about 5 hours, and that would become what it became now.
Yeah.
So, and it just came because I'd just come from being out native title, you know, and going through and being out with my old people. And it's a conversation, and it's offering up a conversation, because a lot of people don't even know what native title is. A lot of mob don't really understand what native title is. So I want to present that and to dismiss those arguments that a lot of, like, Wadjalol people who aren't Aboriginal have this, you know, black people, they get money for nothing, blah, 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 or the mining companies. And they don't actually understand that our old people, their spirit and their bones are being ripped up from the earth. You know, there's actual holes of our soul being taken out as well.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to present on stage.
And kind of present it in a manner that explained the complexities of it and the fact that it's not a black and white situation as much as we wish it could be.
Yeah, not even in your family unit.
Mm, exactly. Yeah. So continuing on with you and your creative endeavours, you spent 14 years at Eriarkin where you took on quite a few roles, notably creative director and prior to that, associate artist. What kept you there for 14 years?
I think Eriarkin is, so Eriarkin Aboriginal Theatre Company, I think it is probably one of the most prominent Aboriginal First Nations theatre companies in the world. And I stay there because as a writer, as someone who's Aboriginal, I think it's my responsibility to be able to help other people who are mob to learn how to write. And, you know, in that time, I've seen you as a writer come through. I've seen Seb definitely will. I've seen Gabe come through. I've seen Barbara Hostelik.
For context, Seb and Gabe are my brothers.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue on.
Barbara Hostelik, I remember the first time she ever came to a writing group when Aunty Irma Woods was running it. This is in like 2013, maybe a bit earlier. And I remember she read the first version of Kangaroo Shoe. And it was so funny because she'd just written Cracked, which is this incredible piece of writing. Love it.
Oh, she's the most phenomenal writer, but also the most humble person in existence.
Yeah.
I'm like, where's your, babe, you're great.
Yeah, she's so boss. And I remember I just finished watching Cracked. And she's like, oh, yeah, but what about Kangaroo Shoe? I'm like, don't care about Kangaroo Shoe.
Let's talk about Cracked.
I want to hear all about Cracked. Go on, talk to me about that, you know. And so the reason I keep coming back is because I feel like it's my responsibility to help our mob come through, tell our stories. I've got this theory that if you're writing, your first piece is about trauma. Your first major piece is about trauma. It's about what you've experienced. And once you're able to get through that, that's when you start coming from your core, from your heart, and that's when the stories start coming from your mind, from your dreaming, from your old people.
Yeah.
And that's where you get that real sweet spot where you can harbour our people to start telling these stories that are absolutely amazing, because I don't know if you mob have seen how many rehashes are happening in Hollywood at the moment, but there's a real need for originality, and as the first original storytellers, you know.
I mean, I don't know what it says about me that my first play is a rom-com, but here we are.
Yeah, but it's a very black rom-com.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it is because I'm in it, but you know.
But it's also not just that, like it doesn't have to be something that's, you know, stand up, dulup, spear in your hand.
Well,
like,
that's the thing, right, is that I think a lot of people expect us to create a certain type of work in a certain type of way, but the fact of the matter is that's not all we are.
Yeah.
So it's not all we're going to create, because as much as you said, we create work that talks about our trauma, a lot of our work also is talking about the joy we have despite it.
And love, yep.
Like, I think the fact that we still create work about joy amongst the trauma is the biggest screw you to everything that's happened.
It's also, I suppose, in a more positive way than screw you, I agree with you. Another way I see it is resilience.
It's resilience.
And empowerment as well, yeah.
And it's being like, despite absolutely everything, the fact that we can still create works that inspire joy, I think is a very, as you said, incredibly powerful thing, and something that I'm very proud of.
kayak.
You should be.
Good time. Look at us go. I was reminiscing over the fact that I met you when I was 16, and now here I am interviewing you for a podcast.
It was younger than that.
Was it?
Yeah, you probably don't remember.
I don't remember it. Do you remember?
Yeah. You were all little kids. It was like 2013, first time I met you all. Yeah, long time ago.
We were in like year 8.
Yeah.
We were babies. That was almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
How did we meet?
I don't know. Well, I know we met through Dad, but like, what was this? Do you remember the scenario?
You were just hanging around.
Oh, yeah, sounds about right.
You were all just hanging around. Well, I didn't meet Seb until you were 16, but you and Gabe were there.
Such good eggs. So funny.
Yeah.
So funny. It's like interesting because I'm about to interview Della and I've known her for just about as long. And I'm like, please don't tell silly stories about me in this podcast, Della. I am praying. I mean, Clint already brought up the breaking my toe story. I didn't even bring it up. He brought it up. I was like, this is your podcast, man. I mean, no, this is your interview. What are you doing bringing up my stories?
We used to call your broken Genesis.
Yeah. Did you actually?
No, we didn't. I just put it on the spot.
I mean, to be fair, a lot of people still crack jokes about it. And I'm like, you know what?
That's like your toes were cracked?
That's so funny. Okay. Wow, what a comedic man you are.
What a dad joke.
What a dad joke.
Yeah.
I think how are we going covering? We've covered most things.
We're at about 35 minutes, so we can do a wrap up now.
All right.
Dope.
Gosh, look at us go.
We're doing really well, thank you.
We're just so good at what we do. Look at us go. Okay, so, so I guess as a bit of a wrap up, what do you hope, this is a big question, but anyway, what do you hope like the next generation or just people in general take from your work as a whole?
From my work? I don't know how to answer that purely because I don't look at my work that way as like impactful or anything like that. I can tell you what I hope for the next generation as artists in general, to feel empowered and powerful.
Yeah.
To tell stories with like bold chests, full of courage,
unrelenting. Because as we said, it's built into us. There's a reason why so many Indigenous people are in the arts in some shape or form.
Yeah. I really hope that artists start being able to access lore again, as in L-O-R-E, by the way, for mob who don't know, as in ceremony, you know, so that we have mob who are really strong, spiritually powerful, you know. I know it's not everything, you know, some mob can't access lore anymore, but if you can, to be able to do that and to be able to use that in your spirit so that you can tell your old people's stories, you know.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the point where, we talked about it briefly, but the term is trauma porn. Love that, don't we? Yeah, where it's just a fetishization of black trauma on stage or on screen. So the point where we get past that and we can just talk stories, you know.
And we can say, screw you to the people who expect that of us.
Yeah, we don't even need to the point where that's done. We don't even need to worry about it.
We've done that.
It's gone. It's finished, you know. And I am just really excited to see the imagination of what comes through, like for yourself, a lot of your stories are boss. There's a lot of, and that's true though. A lot of the young people who are writing now are just coming up with these incredible stories that you are so excited to see. And the difference is now between when I was younger and I was starting to write is that technology is so accessible, filming is so accessible, you know, stagecraft is so accessible. You can do so much incredible stuff with a very cheap budget, a place like the Blue Room, you know. And not even the Blue Room, now there's other smaller venues like Rekabyte, you know, who are there to really champion First Nations work, you know. And I'm just excited to see that and to see the cross bench of what comes from, you know, like queer works with black works, you know, and people who come from like trans background or people who are differently abled creating all these works together and to see how that looks.
Yeah.
You know, because at the moment we've been so busy trying to fight for our own voice and our own individual classes as